You ever think about what's sitting at the bottom of a lake? I'm not talking about fishing lures and beer cans, I'm talking about Hellcats, Wildcats, Corsairs, Dauntlesses, Avengers, dozens and dozens of World War II combat aircraft, resting in the cold, dark freshwater of Lake Michigan, right there between Chicago and Milwaukee. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this one's a beauty. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, let me set the scene. It's 1942. America has just been sucker punched at Pearl Harbor, and the Navy needs carrier pilots. Thousands of them, fast, but there's a problem. The Navy's fleet carriers are all deployed in the Pacific, fighting for their lives. You can't pull the Lexington or the Yorktown back to San Diego just to let some kid from Iowa make his first carrier landing. So somebody at the Navy Department had one of those ideas that sounds crazy until you realize it's actually brilliant. They took two old Great Lakes excursion steamers, the C&B and the Greater Buffalo coal-fired paddlewheel ships that used to haul tourists between Cleveland and Buffalo, and they converted them into aircraft carriers. Flat tops welded right on top of the passenger decks. No catapults, no arresting gear worth bragging about. Just a short wooden flight deck, a paddle wheel churning the lake below, and a kid in the cockpit who'd never landed on anything that moved. They commissioned them as the USS Wolverine and the USS Sable. And from 1942 through 1945, those two ships trained over 17,000 Navy and Marine aviators for carrier operations, right there on Lake Michigan, within sight of the Chicago skyline. Now here's where it gets interesting. Carrier qualification is hard enough on a real carrier in calm seas. On a paddlewheel steamer doing about 12 knots, with a flight deck barely 500 feet long, on a lake that could go from glass smooth to 4-foot swells in 20 minutes? It was brutal. The approach speed on an FM-2 Wildcat was around 65 knots. The deck was pitching. The landing signal officer is waving you in with paddles. You're a student with maybe 200 hours total time, and you're trying to plant a fighter on a postage stamp. And a lot of them missed. Not most. Most made it. But enough didn't. Enough bounced over the barrier. Enough caught a gust and went over the side. Enough came in too hot, too slow, too high, too low. The pilots usually got out. The Navy had crash boats standing by, and that cold Lake Michigan water had a way of motivating a man to get out of his cockpit in a hurry. But the airplanes went straight to the bottom over the course of the war. Somewhere around 130 to 140 aircraft ended up on the lake floor. The Navy didn't bother recovering them. There was a war to win, and there were always more airplanes coming off the assembly lines. So they just sank into the silt, settled into the darkness, and stayed there. For decades, nobody thought much about them. Chicago grew. The lakefront filled up with high-rises and parks. Jet airliners started using O'Hare, and 200 feet below the surface, a fleet of warbirds sat in near-perfect preservation. See, that's the thing about Lake Michigan. It's fresh water. Cold fresh water. No salt to eat the aluminum, no marine organisms boring into the wood and fabric. The water temperature at the bottom hovers around 39 degrees year-round. It's essentially a natural refrigerator, and those airplanes, the ones that went in relatively intact, they survived down there in a condition that would make a museum curator weep. The serious recovery work started in the late 1980s and early 90s, driven largely by a man named A. Taylor Vinson, a Chicago businessman and aviation history fanatic, who funded the National Naval Aviation Museum's recovery efforts. The museum down in Pensacola, Florida, wanted to build the finest collection of naval aircraft in the world. And here was this underwater treasure chest just sitting there in their own backyard. The recovery process was something else. Divers would go down, sometimes in near-zero visibility, feeling their way through the silt. They'd find a wing sticking up, a propeller blade, the outline of a fuselage buried in muck. Then they'd rig lifting slings, attach cables, and a barge crane on the surface would slowly, gently pull the airplane up from the bottom. Imagine standing on that barge when a Grumman Wildcat breaks the surface for the first time in 50 years, water pouring off the wings, silt streaming from the engine cowling, the Navy Star still visible under a thin coat of lake grime, the propeller bent from the impact but the airframe intact, the cockpit instruments still in their mounts. Some of these airplanes came up with the pilot's personal effects still inside. A glove, a chart, a pencil, they pulled up dozens of aircraft. SBD Dauntlesses, the dive bomber that turned the tide at Midway. TBM Avengers, the torpedo bomber a young George H.W. Bush flew in the Pacific. FM2 Wildcats, the stubby little Grumman fighter that held the line at Guadalcanal, F-6F Hellcats, F-4U Corsairs, even a couple of SNJ Texan trainers. Now pulling an airplane out of a lake is one thing. Making it fly again is something else entirely. And that's where the real magic of this story lives. Let me tell you about one airplane in particular. Bureau number 92102, an SBD-2P Dauntless, a photo reconnaissance variant, recovered from Lake Michigan in 1991. This airplane had been underwater for nearly 50 years. When they pulled it out, the fabric control surfaces were gone, the engine was locked solid with corrosion, and the airframe was coated in decades of lake bottom grime. Most people would have looked at it and seen scrap metal. But the folks who took it on didn't see scrap. They saw a Dauntless, the airplane that sank four Japanese carriers at Midway. The airplane that changed the course of the Pacific War in 5 minutes of screaming vertical dives. And they were going to make it fly again. The restoration took years. Every rivet hole had to be inspected. Every spar had to be X-rayed. The Wright R1720 engine, the same nine-cylinder radial that powered so many Navy types, had to be completely rebuilt. They sourced parts from other wrecks, from surplus dealers, from old Navy warehouses that hadn't been inventoried since Eisenhower was president. The dive brakes, those distinctive perforated flaps that slowed the Dauntless in its near-vertical attack dive, had to be fabricated from original drawings. When that airplane finally flew again, painted in its wartime navy blue with the white star on the fuselage, the sound of that Wright radial coming to life was something you felt in your chest. That engine hadn't run since a student pilot in a leather helmet was trying to land on a converted excursion steamer, and there it was, turning a three-blade Hamilton Standard propeller through clean air, 50 years later. That's not the only one. Several of the Lake Michigan recoveries have been restored to flying condition. Others went to museums across the country. The National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola has some of the finest examples. The Kalamazoo Air Zoo, which is right there in Michigan, has a gorgeous wildcat that came up from the lake. The National World War II Museum in New Orleans has benefited from these recoveries, but the ones that fly, those are the ones that get to me. Because here's what I think about. Some kid, 18, 19 years old, from a farm town somewhere in the Midwest, he climbed into that cockpit in 1943. He was scared, his palms were sweating in his leather gloves, the engine was loud, that Wright radial just hammering away, and the lake wind was bouncing the Wolverine's deck under him. The LSO gave him the cut, and he came in and something went wrong. Maybe a crosswind gust, maybe he flared too high, maybe the hook skipped the wire, and the next thing he knew, he was in the water, scrambling out of the cockpit as the airplane nosed under and disappeared.
He swam to the crash boat. They pulled him out, wrapped him in a blanket, probably gave him a cigarette and a cup of coffee, and a week later, he was back at it. He qualified, he got his carrier wings. He shipped out to the Pacific and flew combat missions off a real carrier. In the slot, behind the island. Third airplane in the landing pattern. Doing it for real over deep blue water with a Japanese submarine, maybe lurking underneath. And the airplane he left behind in Lake Michigan just sat there, waiting. Patient as only an inanimate thing can be, until somebody decided it mattered enough to bring it back. That's what restoration is. When you get right down to it, it's deciding that something matters enough to bring it back. It's not just metalwork and engine rebuilding and fabric covering, it's an act of memory. You're saying this airplane and the people who flew it, they deserve to exist in the present tense, not just as a photograph in a book, not just as a line in a Navy logbook, but as a living, breathing, flying machine that you can hear and smell and feel. The smell, by the way, you ever been close to a radial engine at idle? Exhaust, hot oil, avgas, and something else, something metallic and alive that no other machine produces. When one of those Lake Michigan warbirds fires up for the first time in half a century, that smell fills the hangar, and every old pilot in the room gets quiet for a second, because that smell connects you directly to the young men who flew these things in anger, over oceans, in weather, at night, against people who were trying to kill them. The Lake Michigan recoveries are still happening, though at a slower pace now. The easier ones have been brought up. What's left are deeper, more damaged, more silted over, but the technology keeps improving, and every now and then another one comes up. Side-scan sonar has mapped most of the wreck sites. There are probably still aircraft down there that nobody has positively identified yet. And Chicago just goes about its business right above them. Commuters on the Metra, tourists on Navy Pier, sailboats on a summer Saturday afternoon, and down below in the cold and the dark, a fleet of warbirds keeps its silent vigil.
Most of what I shared today comes from reporting by the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, and the excellent work done by the Naval History and Heritage Command,
along with the researchers and dive teams who've been mapping and recovering these aircraft since the late 80s. If you want to go deeper, the museum's collection records are worth every minute. Find more at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Go visit one of those restored Lake Michigan warbirds if you get the chance. Stand close enough to hear the engine tick as it cools down, and remember the kid who left it in the lake so he could go win a war.